Well, thank you. I've got a very growly voice. I apologize. Is that working for you? Yes. Good. Well, thank you, Matthias. So this is joint work with Joe Wei, who's there he is. So if my voice gives out, Joe Wei will come up here and he'll finish off the talk for me, because he knows everything here. So I'm going to talk about a mathematical way of putting ingredients together that I think tries to reflect some kind of financial reality. We're able to do things a little differently from how people have done in the past because of one or two new ideas, which I'll kind of point to, but I won't go into great detail about them because 40 minutes is not that long, and there's quite a bit to be said. But the use of time change Brownian motions has been quite prevalent in finance. Modeling stock price, it's very natural to generalize Black-Scholes model by putting in this time change idea. And the reason is because the zero correlation that you observe in returns is very naturally coded in to time changing Brownian motion. So it's really connected with an essential aspect of asset pricing. Time change Brownian motions have not been used in credit risk very much, but that's because of a couple of technical snags that we're going to avoid in this kind of modeling framework. So let's go back to Finance 001. Introductory finance, a stylized balance sheet takes assets and liabilities and equates them, but then the liabilities of a firm are divided into debt and equity. So basically, equity is what's left after the debt is paid. The solvency condition is that equity can never go negative if it hits. So somehow the assets have to always be at least as large as the debt value. And a very stylized solvency condition is to say that the log leverage, namely the log of the ratio of the assets to debt, should be positive. And so the stylized mathematical definition of default would be the first time that solvency condition is broken. Namely, the log leverage becomes less than or equal to zero. So we'll take this kind of as given, and it reflects corporate reality, but then real life is never this simple, and part of the interest ongoing will be to revisit very basic definitions and try to improve, make it more realistic. Well, models, if we're going to take those ingredients, we ought to take the three processes, the value, firm value V. I should try the, that works. Okay, the three balance sheet entries should be dynamic, and we ought to be able to model them. Of course, there's an identity that V is V plus E. Well, if we're going to do this, we have to be versatile, flexible, we have to be able to do a lot of the things that Tom was doing in his talk, we have to be creative. But there's some mathematical finance principles. We want time consistency, we want no arbitrage, and we want computational efficiency to be able to do what Tom does, computing 100 name CDOs. Requires some good modeling. So just for fun, I put up here my own, movie rating system, the various models, the classic Merton model, the Black-Cox model, reduced form modeling framework, some more recent work by Carr, Wu, Linetsky, and then my own or our own little home approach. Using time change Brownian motion, and just to give myself a pat on the back. I give myself 2 stars in terms of realism and flexibility, because I honestly think it's more flexible than these classic models. Well, reduced form modeling, I think I should have put a 2 star there. That was a mistake. I didn't think I should put. Okay. But any other places, it's probably comparable to these other approaches. The multi-name dependence, can you incorporate multi-names in an efficient way? I give Merton a kind of time inconsistency property. It seems basically time inconsistent, whereas Black Cox is the time consistent realization of Merton approach. Okay, so what are we going to take as the ingredients in time change Brownian motion? Of course, Brownian motion and a time change. So we're going to take a probability setting that has a Brownian motion, which I'll write in this form. It starts off at time zero at some positive value, and then has a volatility and a drift. Now the time change is an independent. It has to be independent in this framework. Very has to be independent of the Brownian motion, and it's just a strictly increasing CAD lag process at starting at zero. And for computational purposes, turns out I rest highly, or generally we rely heavily on having some explicit or semi-explicit formula for the time change. So the flexibility we have is largely through the flexibility of different time change processes that have reasonable Laplace exponent process. So we'll put these ingredients together. What we're going to model in the first instance is the log leverage ratio, which I'll call X. And X will be the Brownian motion evaluated at the stochastic time. So the Brownian, the log leverage at time t is the Brownian motion evaluated at gt. So the second bullet point here is the critical innovation that perhaps other people didn't realize, and I bored myself silly by making this point many, many times over the last couple of years, but for people, it's still worth thinking about. The classic first passage problem is taken, it's what you have to solve if you're going to use this solvency condition that the company stays out of default until the log leverage ratio hits zero. Obviously, you have to figure out the probabilities associated with the time that this process hits zero. And the unfortunate thing is that outside of Brownian motion, this is extremely hard to compute. So what we've done in the second line here is we've changed the definition of first passage time. This is not the classic definition of first passage coming out of stochastic process. That's why I call it the second kind. And it's applicable only to time change Brownian motions. It's not true in more general Levy processes. You can't write this down. But very simply, the first passage time that we will consider is you look for the first time that the time change exceeds the first passage of the underlying Brownian motion. So you see, you look at the Brownian motion problem and you solve its first passage problem, and then you go back and ask what's the first time that the time change jumps or exceeds the first passage time of the Brownian motion. So it's this embedded two-level definition that's the innovation. And this is perfectly natural. The moment you try to compute first passage times, you see you're at an impasse. You can't do it. But if you just change the definition, it'll work for you in this setting. So I usually show a picture here that then confuses the heck out of everybody, but I'm not going to show that today. So we're going to accept this. It's more or less equivalent. I mean, it's like, what is your definition of default? Well, true default is something in the real world. We're just coming up with a mathematical hypothesis that it can behave like this. So the proof of the pudding is in the eating. We have to see whether this framework will be reproducing observable facts. So I can't. Okay, it's very similar. If you simulate paths, a lot of times the two definitions coincide. And sometimes they're identical. But as a general principle, they're different. Okay. So I can argue that it's as good as the previous definition that people would be working with. So here are three different kinds of time changes, and I just highlight that they have nice formulas, at least the first two, nice formulas for the Laplace exponent, and basically that's all we will need to do some heavy lifting in formulas. So when the time change is a Levy subordinator, namely an independent increment process that increases, then you get a particularly nice class of time change Brownian motions. That's the exponential subordinator, or the variance gamma comes from a gamma process for the time change. But then the third one here, you can have a time change which is the integral of an intensity or a speed. And the speed should be a positive process. It could be a CIR process, in which case there is an explicit formula for the Laplace exponent. So here's what you get when you simulate something which includes all of those effects. The time change can sort of grow along. This would be the CIR component, but then the exponential component will jump a noticeable amount infrequently, and then it'll go along like this. This is another term where there's a mean reversion effect in the speed. So that would be typical of a, it's hard to explain what the ingredients are, but you get the idea that we can, this came out of an analytical formula. This is not a, it was very tractable to have a process like that. Okay, so we need, in order to compute this first passage problem, which we need to do everywhere in credit risk, you need to be able to understand perfectly the Brownian motion problem. Well, everybody who studied probability theory has studied the first passage for Brownian motion, and I only quote the main result, that you can jointly model the time of the first passage, and this is a slightly, perhaps a non-standard distribution function, but you get the idea that conditioned on no default at time t, what is the distribution of Brownian motion at that time? And it's a classic formula involved coming out of the reflection principle. But then it turned out that Joe Way and I, this wasn't useful enough, and so we rewrote it in this way, which is I'm very attached to this formula. I haven't found it in a book yet, but I suspect it is somewhere in the literature. Of course, it's not as nice as this because it's left as an integral. But if you think about it, the t dependence is in here, in the exponent. That's the only place. And then the x and y dependence are in sines and cosines and exponentials. So more or less, it's all in the complex exponential form. And so this is a beautiful, you can look at it in the t variable, the x variable, and the y variable. And it's related to the Fourier transform, and all three variables are a Laplace transform and the t variable. So it's a very, very nice form. So what happens when you time change? Well, the basic fact of the new kind of time change is that you get the equivalent function is got by iterated expectations. First, you do an inner expectation with the Brownian motion, and then you do an expectation of the Brownian motion formula evaluated at stochastic time. So that's the reason why this method works. And then you see from the previous formula, the only place that GT will enter will be replacing T here by GT, and you're doing an expectation of the result. Well, that's the moment, that's the characteristic function or moment generating function of the time change. So the only change is to stick the time change rests there in the red part. From this formula, you get closed forms for bond prices, CDS prices, and all of that. You can model various features at this point. So we did. We spent a lot of time making a robust calibration method. It's not that straightforward to fit this kind of model to data. Just summarize the results for the VG subordinator. Here's a bunch of parameters. Don't look at them very much. The point is that these parameters work for 18 months. and then the second set of parameters work for the subsequent 18 months. So we're taking parameters for an awful long time. And the fit is, let's just see if I can make this movie work. It's probably going to play. It's probably not going to work. Okay, so these are the credit default spread curves. Daily over a three-month period, the blue line is observed and the green is calibrated in the model with the VG model. So that was it. Actually, I'm not sure if that was it. So this is over a three-month period. Actually, that's not a great movie. I was looking around for a good version of the movie, but you get the idea that the dynamics. It's fitting the observed curve. Now here are two snapshots on different days for Ford in 2006 and at the end of 2008 during the middle of the credit crunch. Ford was a disaster. It was a basket case paying over 100% nominal interest rate on its at least equivalent to on its CDS curve. And three different versions of the time change model are there. The black bars are the bid-ask spread on the credit default swap quotes. So you're sort of within the bid-ask spread most of the time with all three of these models. So, okay, so now to change horses, the only thing that's changing in that model as time goes by is the log leverage. We actually don't observe directly the log leverage rate. We have to fit daily. We take the value of the log leverage rate that minimizes the error, the root mean squared error, and then we get a time series of the log leverage rate ratio. And this is how it looks. The log leverage ratio for the first 18 months, Ford was doing okay, actually improving. The health of the company was going up. And then the second 18 months, starting in July 07, just kind of a disaster for Ford. But I snuck in one more line here. The black line is the underlying stock price for Ford. And you see the stock price is doing very close to what this X process is doing. Suggests that a one-factor model isn't that bad for jointly modeling the equity and the credit default swaps. So that's the inspiration for the second half of my talk. So this is kind of old work, and what I want to tell you about is new work, which picks up from the point, well, we should be modeling the stock and the log leverage jointly in such a way that we can preserve all of the good stuff and get more information. So this is one aspect of what I'm calling the time change Brownian motion program, or I created a brand name for it. But other work that we've been doing is on portfolio credit risk, CDO pricing. I have some new ideas on modeling the financial system, but today I'll concentrate on this idea that, based on the previous slide, that we should be looking at stock and log leverage together to understand more about Ford. So let's talk about capital structure again, and I pose the question, how much of the capital structure of a firm is revealed in the daily data traded on the firm? The most accessible data are credit default swap data, bond prices, and that's telling you about the debt side of the firm and the firm value. But then the stock price is telling you, the stock price and dozens of stock options that are traded are giving you insight to the way equity and debt are interwoven. So it must be that the market assessment of credit and equity through the stock price, stock options, credit swaps should be a useful additional information set that could be more valuable perhaps than balance sheet data, which is updated only quarterly. So a good problem would be, how much can you predict the quarterly report based on pure market observations? How well does market data reveal capital structure? Well, I'm hoping if you have a good model, it reveals a lot. So what I'm expecting, a test of a good model, will be that we will be able to work out the capital structure between quarterly reports and then predict some relations in a quarterly report. So there's a lot of literature that I haven't read, I must be honest. I haven't read all of this, but I get the basic idea of much of this. People are very interested in credit capital structure models, and more recently the problem of modeling credit and equity jointly. That's these hybrid models. And a lot of literature on convertible bonds that lies between credit and equity. So the aim of what I want to talk about now is to describe a model that will do a reasonable job of respecting corporate finance rules. It should be consistent with mathematical finance, arbitrage-free modeling. We have to be able to represent the capital structure of a firm. It's got to be useful, so it better be simple enough. But I want to capitalize on the flexibility inherent in the time change Brownian motion. And hopefully this flexibility will give us enough flexibility to actually accurately reflect the market observations of a real firm. Okay, so if you have a model like this, I expect that if you can do better than the competitors, then I would have thought there's lots of opportunities in this kind of area. So hedge funds would be interested in this. You'd like to be able to hedge between equity and credit products, convert all these important securities that cross over between credit and equity need some new modeling ideas. So here's how it goes. So we're going to start, I'll take R equal to zero. It's not necessary, just the formulas are bad enough with R in and R taken out. So this will be a risk-neutral setting. Actually, I should take this out. I'm rewriting everything to include the physical and the risk-neutral measure because we're working hard on the calibration in the physical measure. So we will have the risk-neutral. The physical measure is part of the model, but the traded assets have to be P martingales. So that means the stock price, of course. Stock price should be never negative. And in the model, of course, it's observed, or in real life, it's observed directly. The log leverage ratio is also a non-negative process. It's not observed directly. So the time of default will be the first time the stock is zero. It's also the first time that the log leverage ratio is zero. And in this model, both of them stay at zero once they hit zero. So just like Tom, we're not going to ask too much about the post-default world. We're just going to stop everything at default.
So there is no time change, right?
There's a time change. It's about to come.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So basically my idea is that we had a one-factor model for X. Or at least X was the thing that was important in the credit risk model. Now I want to do the minimal thing. I want two factors. But there's four objects, and they combine in various ways. So there's two factors that you can take any two of these four and model them. Okay, so the relations are V is the firm value. D is like the market value of the debt. Everything's written per share, so the equity per unit share is the stock price. Okay, so stock price is value, firm value minus debt. Log leverage is as before. So these are the formulas that relate for all of the any pair can be computed from any other pair. Now, what's going on here is D of T. Is often in credit risk taken to be a deterministic function. It's the default trigger, so the firm value typically moves, stays above D, but eventually hits the default trigger, and now the stochastic default, the default trigger is a stochastic process. So this generalizes the incomplete information approach to credit risk that people use. So this is just the picture that shows the firm value and the default process and the time at which they hit one another, and thereafter everything flatlined. Okay. So I only want to talk about two independent factors, and it's enough, it's complicated enough. So you can take any two of the four, and as I said. So all of these quantities are related to the financial health of the firm, so they should be positively correlated with the financial health. Now, a healthy firm has a log leverage ratio long way from zero, and hence V much bigger than, substantially bigger than debt. And so S and V start to look similar in this regime. So V should be similar to traditional stock models. And so it's reasonable to take a geometric Brownian motion, or more generally, a time change Brownian motion. So V clearly wants to be a time change Brownian motion. The other consideration is X should admit a solvable first passage problem. And if you put that together with V being a geometric Brownian motion, you're led to D being a geometric, or D should be a time change Brownian motion as well. A geometric time change Brownian motion. Everything, these three are, they don't have to be like this, but the simplest consideration is V, D, and F are P martingales, are risk-neutral martingales. The log of capital V and the log of capital D, or small v and small d, they're taken to be time-change Brownian motions. Okay? Let's stop at the time of default. And here's the simplification. Let's drive them by correlated Brownian motions, but the same time change. Okay? So later, of course, you'll generalize that. So now you want to go through and value all securities in this model, zero coupon bonds, credit default swaps. That's all pretty straightforward. In fact, it only depends most on the X factor alone. The first term only has the log leverage ratio in it. The second one, that has some recovery, some stochastic recovery term that depends on the second factor as well, but it's less important than the first. So the credit side is strongly attached to the X factor. Of course, equity derivatives depend strongly on both factors. So, but now let's consider computing the call option on the stock. Well, when you plug in, if you treat V and D as the fundamental factors, then F is the difference of exponential time change Brownian motions, and so this is not what people prefer. So this is quite a tricky object. It's a spread option on the two underlying on these two underlying V and D. So and then it's got a barrier condition as well, so it's a barrier spread option. Pardon me?
Vulnerable option.
Vulnerable option. Okay. I don't know the name. But I suppose it's explicable. Right. So this set us to thinking, can we compute this thing efficiently? And it turned out that you needed to come up with a new result, which is applicable to all spread options as they arise in all areas of mass finance. This is a two-dimensional version. We're just going to apply the Fourier approach to call or option pricing that's sort of pioneered by Carr Madan, and extend it to the spread option. And it turns out the spread option payoff has an explicit Fourier transform involving the gamma function. So it's essentially expressible in terms of the one-dimensional single-variate, univariate gamma function. So that was our new result. And so using that, you can go ahead and just apply kind of brute force the methods described that people use in the one-dimensional case where we were valuing regular stock options using the fast Fourier transform method. So here it's extended to two dimensions. This theorem, how do you understand it? Well, what it is an explicit two-dimensional Fourier transform in two variables, U and Z. F is the how to describe it? So F is the part where the time change enters through the Laplace exponent. And so this depends on the underlying form for the V and the D process. It depends on various components. Now, I've done some short-circuiting here because V and D are Brownian motions with a common time change, but the Brownian motions is a two-dimensional Brownian motion with correlation in it. Okay, so correlation of those two processes is a very important parameter. You need to diagonalize your Brownian motions in order to separate and go from two-dimensional problems into one-dimensional problems, and that's where the X and the X perp come in. They're just diagonalizing the Brownian motions, making them independent, and so there's a bit of linear algebra in there. Okay, so but basically it's not much more than linear algebra plugging in the payoff, Fourier transform of the payoff, and then doing the expectation that occurs in the risk neutral expectation formula. So you get a double Fourier transform with F completely explicit. Q is you compute once and then you store it, and so you can compute all of different flavors, different maturity dates, and strikes come with the same cue. So this is a formula which, in principle, should amount to just running a double fast Fourier transform every time you want to get a panel of prices for all strikes and all maturities. So in principle, it's very fast to compute. So we can, in this model, compute call options and put options, and that's the nature of this corollary. Okay, so the difficulty is that there's some tweaking that goes on in here due to obvious poles in the integrand here. You need to make complex shifts. And this is familiar in one dimension. And the honest truth is, Joey and I haven't quite resolved all of the ways the shifts go in two dimensions. So I'm going to end up by showing you a slide that still has, I think it's not correct because I think a residue wasn't treated correctly. But this is the market implied, or the model implied vol surface for Ford on a certain date. I promised Joey I wouldn't show this slide because he produced it yesterday and he was very annoyed by this spike here. But I just put it here to show that, you know, in a single, that we can get implied vol surfaces coming out reasonably easy. I think this is an incorrect treatment of the residue, but probably Joe Way will argue the point. But I decided at the last minute I better show at least one implied vol surface, even though it's not adequate. But think of where this came from. This came from taking all of the Ford credit data and working out the dynamics of the log leverage process, then working out putting in the stock, the observed stock price, and working out correlations and extra parameters connected with the stock price, and putting it all together, and then using the formula at face value to compute the implied vol surface. We're not yet able to observe the implied vol surface and solve the inverse problem, which would be to calibrate the model based on observations of the implied vol surface. So these are just first steps in the two-factor case where we're modeling the capital structure with two factors, both of which are related to time change Brownian motions. So we think it's very promising. It hasn't been done before. People haven't looked at such a two-factor model in detail before because they could only deal with the Brownian motion case, which doesn't give an interesting theory. We now have the flexibility to solve it for time change Brownian motions, which are much richer family. So I'm going to, yes? I can't give an explanation for that. I don't know. I don't used to looking at these things in real life. So that's a positive skew. So it seems backwards to you, right? So yeah, moneyness means the strike is way low here, and somehow it's definitely wrong. Yeah, no, I agree, it's wrong. Sorry, I just put it up here just because we can compute such things. I didn't say yet we can compute them correctly. For the model? Oh, these are coming out of the calibration we've done. We've been working with Ford on the credit side. So we calibrated our two-factor model has embedded in it the previous model that I showed fitted to real Ford data on the credit default swap. So we took all those parameters, and then we added additional parameters consistent with the observation of the stock price. So that gave us a correlation between the two factors and some volatilities, enough to then input. So the parameters are taken from the data. but we didn't use the implied vol surface. So we have the implied vol surface on this date from Bloomberg, and we want to see how different they are. But I didn't want to put them on the same slide, because then it would look kind of silly. But yeah, the true implied vol for Ford on that date was flattening out at about 50%. Right. You see, the second factor could be S, and we observe S, right? And so given that we've observed S, now the model is fully predictive. Okay, it predicts this. This is a prediction of the model, okay? So that's what I'm saying. Just based on the stock price and the credit default swap, then this is a prediction for the implied vol surface. Now, the real implied vol surface is not that high. It's down at the level of 50%. So we have some work to do to explain the difference. Okay, but I mean, there's a lot of wiggle room in here. So this is a prediction of the model. I guess that's the important point. Okay, it's predicted on the basis of modeling X as before, and then the new factor is simply the stock price, which we observe. And then putting those together, you get all the parameters of the model, and then it predicts this. Okay. So, just to wrap up, the reason we're doing this is because we're looking at first passage in a new way. Otherwise, we wouldn't go anywhere, so we wouldn't get to first base. So it opens up a whole range of feasible models that have never been studied. What I described today is really it's essential to go from one factor to two factor models, but it's a big step to go to a third factor, so don't ask me about the third factor. I think it's important to understand fully the second factor. So jointly, the four processes here fit together, and how far can you push that? The FFT method is throughout, everything is consistent with having Fourier explicit or semi-explicit Fourier transforms. Now this opens up technical difficulties. How do you actually compute it stably? But we're getting quite experienced with that as well. Now this framework, I promise that it can extend to the multi-firm case, perhaps not in a way that's acceptable to practitioners, but certainly in a way that could be used for for stress testing, modeling, or simulation packages and things like that. So I haven't talked about that in this. So there's a huge amount of work to be done. Like I say, we've opened up a range of models that have never been studied at all. So there's a lot to be done. So I do welcome any comments from people who are using models that are related to this and would like to see more of this kind of approach. We haven't had that much contact with people who really want to use, you know, work in this domain. So if you're interested, please let me know. Okay, so thank you very much. Oh, some papers that are on my website.